Please take your seats so we can start the meeting. Before we begin, we ask that you, if you have a cell phone, that you please turn it off completely and do not text during the meeting. Thank you. My name is David and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous and all are welcome to attend. Kat will now read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Kat. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are a self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you, Kat. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Katie will now read the steps.
Okay. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made a direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry his message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
Thank you, Katie. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Ryan.
My name is Ryan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ryan.
Always grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really never thought I would end up where I am today. And whenever you're the 10-minute speaker, it's like it's really never enough time to share what AA has given to me. Really for me is like, you know, a lot of times in meetings you hear about this like God-sized hole that's within us. And I definitely had that before I even picked up a drink. For me, the behaviors were, you know, I really wanted to be accepted by people, you know, so it was like whenever there was something really stupid that nobody wanted to do, they would just direct the question to me, and I wanted everyone's approval, so I did these things. And, you know, I just, like, constantly found these things that I was trying to pull outside of myself to, like, make me feel whole or make me feel complete in the world. And then I really, I found alcohol, and, you know, my life changed completely. You know, growing up, sports was, like, a big thing in my life, and, like, you know, I was going to become this professional soccer player, and I remember, you know, the first summer that, like, all my friends were getting into drinking and, like, smoking weed and stuff, like, immediately, like, a month after I had picked up, like, all my ambition to, like, do that stuff just disappeared. Like, the only thing that mattered to me was about, like, when I could get the substance next, you know? And for me, it's just, like, you know, I just, like, pushed everything aside when, like, alcohol or substances came into play, you know? You know, I remember this one time where, you know, I was after school, we, like, raided my friend's grandmother's liquor cabinet, and I drank way more than I could. Like, I probably weighed, like, 100 pounds at the time, and then, like, I passed out on my coffee table, pissed myself. You know, my mother, like, rolled me over, and she's like, "You're drunk," and it's like, "Yeah, I don't care," and, like, you know, really, it's just, like, I never thought about how the actions that I had, like, how they affected other people. Like, I never thought of what it was like for my little brother to see his older brother passed out on the coffee table, soaked in urine. You know what I mean? And, like, all I could think about was doing that again because I just hated being alive. Like, it was just, alcohol was just, like, this way for me just to, like, excuse myself from life. And that's really what it did for me. And, you know, I chased that for a long time. And, you know, for me, like, I've had experience being a dry alcoholic and not having a solution. And, like, for me, like, a dry alcoholic without having a solution is, like, leads me to, like, wanting to kill myself. Like, that's really where it leads me is, like, you know, I end up in, like, you know, an institution where, like, you know, it's just my whole, like, everything is destroyed. And so the first time I tried to get sober, I was 19. You know, I got kicked out of my parents' house. I was living on friends' couches. I was just bouncing around. And really, you know, I got sober because, you know, I wanted to, like, get back into my parents' house. I went to Gosnell in the Cape. I spent about 3 months down there. And, like, it was a really great vacation from life because I did nothing to work on what had brought me to the drink. You know, I had cleared up. I had sobered up. You know, I had, like, a fellowship of guys that I was hanging out, but, like, I didn't have to worry about a job. I didn't have to worry about any of the responsibilities of life. And so, you know, I ended up going back home. And, you know, from the first time that I picked up, I was living on a lie. You know, like, I told one person that I hadn't been drinking and that, like, you know, this was the first time when I had, like, already picked up a drink previous before, you know. So, like, the very beginning, I was lying to myself about, you know, my substance use. And for me, like, I don't know what it was, like, somehow I was able to, like, regain, like, some control on making the outside look okay. Like, I got a job, like, I went back to school. And so, like, everybody thought that Ryan was okay, but, like, the truth was, is, like, I was killing myself. You know what I mean? And I was killing myself to defend my right to drink. And, like, that's what it was for me, is, like, this constant phase where I'm fighting for my right to control my drinking and fighting for my right to, like, defend my drinking. And really it was, like, because I was so scared to death of the world and I didn't even know it. And I was able to hold it together for, you know, about 5 years. You know, I was 24 and, like, you know, this girl that was, like, going to be the one, like, broke up with me because I was, like, stealing all these pills and, like, doing all this shady stuff. And, you know, for me it was, like, you know, my parents looked at me and they just said, like, you know, you're either going to get out of this house or you're going to get sober. You know what I mean? And I don't know what it was this time, but, like, you know, I accepted some form of help. And, you know, this place that I went to, this, like, day rehab place, had this stuff on the weekends. And, like, you know, I went there, like, on a Saturday, and I was miserable, and I was telling them how I wanted to kill myself. And, you know, the lady took me into her office and she's like, "Do you want help?" And, like, I was broken and I said yes. And I didn't know what help meant at the time, but what help that meant at that time meant was, like, there was an ambulance waiting outside for me and they were trying to take me into a psych ward. And, like, you know, I go out there and I'm yelling at the cops and saying, like, "How dare you?" you know, and like, you know, I call my mom and I'm complaining on the phone about like how these people wronged me. And she's just like, well, what do you expect in a, like a medical field when you say you're going to hurt yourself? Like, obviously they're going to take action. And, you know, for me, like I convinced these cops that I wasn't getting in that ambulance, and I had a cop car drive behind me and a cop car drive in front of me to the hospital. And then I walked into a psych ward and I was like willingly giving my things over. And like, for me, like, I don't know what it was, like, you know, this situation could have continued to happen, but like, this was a moment in my life where I was just really sick and tired of doing this. And after that, you know, I tried AA, you know what I mean? Like, I had never really thought of AA as a solution. And, you know, I kind of bounced around to meetings in the beginning, and like, I, you know, nothing really happened until I like found a group, and like nothing happened until like I told people what was going on in my life. And really, like, you know, my experience in AA has been one that has given me like a life where I had so much going on that like I never would have imagined that I could deal with anything that's going on in my life today. Like, the idea when I was active of like having to like move out on my own and pay like rent and like be an adult was like the scariest thing to me. You know what I mean? Like, I kept my life very small, because I didn't feel like I could do anything. And like, for me, you know, I met a group of guys that like, you know, showed me what AA was about. You know, they brought me through the steps. They showed me about what sponsorship was. They showed me about being active in groups. And really, like, you know, for the first 3 years of being in AA, like, I eat, sleep, and defecated AA, like, all the time. And like, really, like, it was, you know, my life was very safe in AA, you know what I mean? It was really easy to practice these principles in all my affairs in Alcoholics Anonymous. And like, you know, really what this, what like, you know, where I am today is like, this program is asking me to practice these in all my affairs, right? And so like, life has given me all these gifts where like, you know, today it's like, I'm in a job where people look to me for answers, where before, like, I had no answers ever, right? You know, and like, that's, you know, that's because of like, you know, a contact with a higher power that I've created, you know. And like, you know, I'm in grad school where like I didn't ever think I was going to graduate high school, you know. And like, so all these things in my life have made everything really full, you know. And it's almost, it's been like a very difficult transition for me to like not be able to spend as much time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what I mean. And it's just, my relationship with the higher power has been like really important, because like I haven't been able to like attend the same amount of meetings and do the same amount of stuff that I've been able to do in the past. And like today, it's like, you know, what I've learned in this is like, how am I carrying myself in the world, you know, outside of AA? And like, can I continue this conscious contact with a higher power? Because like, you know, everybody always used to say to me, like, you know, there's going to come a day when like you just like are going to be on your own, and like you're not going to have AA, and like you're going to need something. You know, and like, to me, like, you know, that doesn't always mean a drink. You know, for me today, it means like, you know, my first response when life is stressful is like not a drink. Like, it's like, oh my God, I'm going insane, and I want my mind to stop, and I just want to freaking fall asleep at night. You know, like, for me, like, you know, when the wheels get turning, it's like, you know, that relationship with a higher power is like really important. And like, it's just been, I don't know, what I've learned in AA has been amazing. You know, just the fourth step where like, you know, I can, well, really the 10th step where like on a daily basis, I can really look at myself and who I'm being in the world and like recognize like the relationships I'm building with the world around me. I mean, like, that is like the biggest gift today, you know, because when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt isolated. I felt like I was on an island and I felt like I didn't belong. And today, like, Alcoholics Anonymous taught me about being able to belong in the world, like not just in a meeting, but like I can go out into the world and feel like I belong, you know, because of the tools that the 12 steps have given me. So thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Ryan. Oh, it is. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. Our second 10-minute speaker is Melanie.
Hi, I'm Melanie. I'm alcoholic. Hi, my home group is Davis Square Unity. We meet on Monday nights in Somerville. I have the privilege of serving that group as their general service representative. I sponsor women. I take them through these steps, and I have a sponsor, and I am sponsored. And being sponsored is a lot more difficult than just having a sponsor, I found. I'm really nervous. I was expecting a lot fewer people because it's the day before a holiday. I guess I was wrong. But I'm really grateful to be here, so thank you to the Beacon Group for asking me to speak tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege. My sobriety date is February 7th of 2011. This is not my first experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up pretty much the same way of a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, feeling misunderstood, feeling apart from, and trying desperately to fit in and trying desperately to be what I thought you wanted me to be and to feel the way you looked. And there's a loneliness that alcoholics know that no one else in this world can comprehend that I felt. It was just, it wasn't a feeling anymore. It was just kind of a place where I was. My first experience, what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous was ultimately not alcohol. I went to treatment for outside issues. I didn't understand what the problem was. They told me I was alcoholic, so because I wanted to fit in, I was like, okay, I'm alcoholic. And, they told me to work these steps, so I, worked out of some workbook they gave me, and I had no conception of what my problem was. So needless to say, after 11 and a half months of consecutive treatment, I did not stay sober. I went to meetings. I really liked going to meetings. People were always really friendly to me. I remember people smiling a lot, and they would always do things together, and the fellowship in the state where I got sober was amazing. Like, people welcomed me in, just by inviting the women at the treatment center that I was at. They would say, oh, join us for this event or this event, and I had no idea what was happening. And apparently while I was there, the International Convention of AA was happening in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But I'd never heard of that before, and I'll get to that in a minute. But that was my, initial experience was just, oh, you just go to meetings and, somehow you get happy. And I had no understanding of what, the program was that people talked about, that it was working the 12 steps. I had to do a lot more experimenting, and I was in and out of this fellowship for approximately, essentially 11 years. I'll flash forward a bunch of years. I was 18 when I went to treatment. So a bunch of years later, I graduated from college eventually. If you had asked me that day, I think it was June or July, if I was going to pick up a drink that day, I would have told you no. I was going to a lot of meetings, kind of. At that point, I don't think I was going anymore. I had a lot of friends. I used to fellowship a lot, and I drank a lot of Red Bull, and I went to a lot of young people's conventions, and ran around, did a bunch of wild and crazy things, and it was a lot of fun. But again, I had no idea what my problem was. So I never truly identified in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand what you had and what made me like you. So I went to a lot of meetings and told you why I didn't belong there. So the day that I picked up a drink, I remember walking into the store to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I walked out with a bottle of booze. And I drank for 3.5 years. And there were times in that 3.5 years where I could take it or leave it. There were times in the 3.5 years where I had a lot of fun. And I had a host of friends, and I fit in really well, and it was great. Things were wonderful. But at the same time, everything on the inside felt like it was caving in. And I couldn't figure out how to fix that. So I would try any kind of substitute possible to do that. There came a point, I moved out to Boston, and I was walking by the bar. It was a Sunday before. It was the Super Bowl Sunday in 2011. And I walked by the bar, and I saw a friend in there. I was like, oh, I'm just going to go in. I'm not going to drink, because I had been asked by or told by my doctor, I had been given a very sufficient reason to not drink. And the next thing I remember is that I had my fist on the bar, asking myself how I'd gotten here again. And I don't even remember where that again came from, because I never really felt like I had gotten there before, but there was that feeling. And I had this moment of clarity, and it was just a moment, and it lasted maybe an eighth of a second. But it was enough for me to realize that no reason was sufficient enough for me to not take that first drink. And once I take that first drink, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And that moment of clarity was enough for me to leave that bar that night. And the next day, I went to my first meeting back in Alcoholics Anonymous, which was Unity. And it was freezing cold. And I was going back, you know, by that point, I was going back to AA because I wanted my partner at the time to get sober because he had a problem. And I didn't think I had a problem still because I could take it or leave it. When clearly the night before, I couldn't take it or leave it. And somebody reached out their hand to me and said, welcome. And I couldn't remember anyone previously ever welcoming me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And then they had me greet with them, which I really didn't like. No one had done that before, and I didn't know why I had to shake people's hands. And then they made me sit with them in the front, and I definitely didn't want to sit in the front. And I tried to explain to all these women who took me aside and welcomed me in and explained to them why I didn't belong there and why I was there for my partner. And a funny thing happened at the end of the meeting. We have what's called a fellowship rep at our home group, and they invite you out to eat for food after the meeting, and they invited me to come along. And I had spent the majority of my time talking to them, saying why I didn't belong there, and they still wanted me to join them. And so I went. And then they said, hey, come back next week. And I didn't go to a meeting for that entire week, but I went back to Unity the next week, and I, like, not drinking, it was really odd, and I don't remember the first few months of my sobriety, but I went back to Unity every week after that. And I went to a few meetings here and there, and eventually I heard a woman who I identified with for the first time in 11 years, and I asked that woman to be my sponsor, and she shared her experience with the Big Book with me. I'm the scum on the bottom of your shoe. Like, she took time for me. And as a result of working the 12 steps out of the Big Book, I just remember having that feeling, like, I hadn't thought about drinking. I felt lighter, and I was a little bit freer. And then I thought that was all I had to do. And then a woman asked me to sponsor her. And she didn't stay sober, and she didn't stick around, but I did. And I didn't really understand the concept of that. And over the next few years, for the next several years at this point, I've had new experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had the opportunity and the privilege of going to the International Convention down in Atlanta in July. If you don't know what that is, we can talk after the meeting, but you know, it's like sponsorship. It's an experience you must not miss. Sitting in a room of, you know, I don't know, 50,000 plus alcoholics saying the Lord's Prayer together was probably one of the most powerful things I'd ever heard. Being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me taught me what it means to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and what my problem is, and the fact that I can't take one drink and not continue to drink, and that my thinking is what's going to take me back out every single time, because I think I'm okay, and I think I don't need you guys, and I think I don't need God, and therein lies the big problem. I think the power lies within myself, and it doesn't, which I've come to find time and time again in all aspects of my life. In serving as GSR, signed up for a subscription for the Grapevine, which has, I didn't know what the Grapevine was, because I had been sober a while and been around at Alcoholics Anonymous for, you know, some 15 odd years, and I don't need the Grapevine. And I learned something from the people around the world and around the United States and Canada about their experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to learn from their experience, and that's truly a privilege. So today I am relatively happy, I'm relatively joyous, and I'm relatively free, and You know, I got to spend the day with my best friend who's visiting from out of town, and I never thought I'd say I had a best friend. You know, I have a relationship with my higher power, and for that I'm truly grateful. Thank you again for allowing me to share, and that's all. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Melanie. My name is Sarah, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Beacon Group, and if you are visiting from out of town or here for the first time tonight, we are delighted that you are here. We will now observe the seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, a $2 donation is recommended so that AA can remain self-supporting. Thanks in advance for your generosity. We have AA literature available on the table to this, or on the piano over there. If you don't have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't leave here tonight without one. It sells for $8, but if you don't have the funds, you make very liberal credit arrangements. And we also have meeting directories available, and these are free. Sponsorship is a cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are a newcomer and you don't have a sponsor, we strongly suggest you get one. Please see Anna, and I don't see Casey tonight, so you can see Ryan. We fill in. After the meeting, they will be stationed by the door. And if you are looking to be a sponsor, feel free to talk to Ryan or Anna as well, or see the sign-up sheet on the membership table. We have three ongoing monthly commitments. First up is our commitment at the South Bay, or two now, I'm sorry. First, soon to be three, I think. First up is our commitment at the South Bay House of Corrections. This will be on Friday, December 11th at 8 p.m. Remember, we can only take five people at a time, and I don't see Patrick here tonight, so you can see me if you'd like to go to that. And next, we have our commitment at Whitten Hospital in Everett. This takes place Tuesday, December 15th at 7 p.m., and I believe Allie is the person to see if you want to go to that. I don't see her in the room, although I thought you can see Sarah R. And another quick announcement, Cecily lost her black knit cap here last week. It's by North 66, is that right? And so if you, it's her favorite cap, and so if you found it, she'd be very grateful if you would return it to us. Thank you.
AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in much the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Teddy has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Teddy, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Oh, that's the wrong ones. Close. There we go. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility outside enterprise. These problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Every AA group ought to be fully supporting declining outside contributions. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. AA as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Anonymity, I mean. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Teddy. Tonight, our main speaker is Greg.
I'm Greg Plagueis, alcoholic.
Hi.
I have a home group. It's the Tuttucket Speakers Group. We meet on Thursday nights in Brantford, Connecticut. 8 p.m. We're a one-hour speaker meeting. If you're ever in Brantford, Connecticut, Thursday night, 8 p.m. On the town green, come check us out. 8 o'clock. It's pretty cool. I just said a home group. I have a sobriety date. It's August 15, 2001. I'm happy about that today, really am. I wasn't always happy about my sobriety date. Today, thankfully, I'm happy about my sobriety date. I have a sponsor, Peter G. He's a member of the Raleigh Big Book Group in Raleigh, North Carolina. And you know Peter? Cool. I have the privilege of sponsoring other alcoholics today. I got this thing, it's called an ego, and it wants to kill me. It will pop out very soon. The thing about it is it wants me to impress you. It wants me to sound good. Like at one point I want you to probably be crying, maybe shed a tear, laugh a little bit. And then by the end you're going to be standing on your chair clapping. But the reality is that's probably going to happen. But that's what goes on in my head. My head is a weird place. For literally, for probably about 6 minutes, I was trying to decide, should I go to the left or should I go to the right? It seemed a very difficult decision for me. I was like, I'm probably going to get judged this particular way if I choose that way and if I go this way. And yeah. You know, looking back with some hindsight and clarity, like, thanks, Ryan and Melanie. I related a lot. You know, looking back with some hindsight and clarity, I can clearly see today that I was suffering from alcoholism as far back as I can remember. I don't have that great of a memory, but as far back as I can remember, I can clearly see I was suffering from it. I mean, I suffered that hole in the soul. You know, I suffered that void and that loneliness that we know so well. You know, it's one thing to be alone in a room of no people, completely by yourself, and to feel lonely. I mean, you have a reason to feel alone, but to walk this earth day in and day out for years in a world full of people and feeling absolutely and completely alone is the worst feeling in the world. Especially sometimes, I mean, I would sit around on days like tomorrow, Thanksgiving, you know, sit around at the dinner table with my family, and my mom would joke that I was dropped off by gypsies on the front door, but I clearly have her nose, so I knew that wasn't true. But the reality was, is I would sit down at the dinner table and I would look around, and I'm like, God, I am not like these people. Like, the mothership is going to come one day and it's going to teleport me and I'm going to go off and they're going to be like, sorry, you know, you belong here, not here. But that was just the feeling I had as far back as I can remember. And it's crazy because a lot of these things, if you knew me, if you knew me back then, you know, from age 0 to 15, I mean, you looked at my life. I grew up in a really nice suburb of New Haven, Connecticut, a town called Orange, you know, middle to upper class. I lived in a really big house, and, you know, I had a lot of nice toys growing up, and, you know, I was played on a lot of sports teams, and my room was full of trophies and plaques and ribbons, and, you know, I had a bunch of friends growing up. You know, I was always given everything that I wanted. I definitely was spoiled, but my family also provided everything that I needed. I mean, they really did just shower me with love and attention and just were always there for me and absolutely, completely supported me in everything, you know. If my family, if they did anything wrong, they probably loved me too much. I mean, but the thing is that's not how I felt. You know, I felt like I could have had Mother Teresa and Gandhi as parents, and they still wouldn't have done a good enough job. Like, they still wouldn't have given me enough attention and love and support, you know? It's like I just had this, like, this vacuum, this void, this emptiness, that no matter how much of whatever it was that I thought I needed and I would get it, it just seemed like it then still wasn't enough, you know? Like, I had the new Air Jordans, but then they weren't good enough, so I needed the Bo Jacksons. I mean, literally, I probably had more shoes growing up than Payless Shoe Store. I mean, I would have shoes that were in boxes that I never even took out of boxes just because I had to have them because they matched this hat that I had, which I had throughout my whole room. I mean, they had to build shelves in my room just so I can put my hats on and stuff. I mean, it was insane, you know? Like, my mind just constantly raced and was so consumed to what you thought about me growing up, you know? I mean, if there was one word to describe my childhood and at the core of my alcoholism, that pit, that loneliness, that void, it was fear. It was all fear, you know? I mean, of course, I was so in delusion that I couldn't see that at that time. I mean, I didn't know as a 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, like, oh, I'm suffering from a spiritual malady that is driven by self-centered fear. Like, this is what this is. No, I mean, and I saw professionals and doctors and therapists, and they had lots of fancy names and labels and, you know, medications that they wanted to give me as a child growing up. But I tell you, the one thing that I feel that I latched onto the most was sports. There was something about sports for me. It was almost like it was my first solution. It was like my first drink. I mean, like, I would put the pads on and the helmet on. I'd go out there on the field, and there was this sense of unity and camaraderie. I felt truly a part of something. We had this purpose and this mission and this goal, and it was like for 3 hours out there, like, my head was completely quiet, you know? And then the game would be over. And I'd be in the shower and washing up, and I put clothes on and be back in my mom's car, and it, like, back to my head, you know? So as any good alcoholic, I found this relief, and it gave me a pretty profound amount of it. I was excessive. I joined the track team. They didn't have a position that says, you want to do high jump? I'm like, sure, okay, no problem, I'll do high jump. I was the worst high jumper, but I needed to do something. I joined the swim team. I didn't even know how to swim. I joined the swim team. I played soccer. I played football. I played basketball. I started signing up for camps where I'm learning how to ride horses and shoot guns and archery. I mean, like, literally, I was constantly doing something. I just never felt like I could just be, you know? And today, with some hindsight and clarity through the process of these 12 steps, like, it's very clear to me, you know, that alcohol and drugs never was the problem. I mean, by the time I was 15 years old, it became, and it was, my solution. You know, I'm not a problem drinker. You know, if I was a problem drinker, it would be very clear. You know, once I pick up a drink and I got to the point where I felt I couldn't stop, you know, and it caused all these problems, and all I would need to do is put it down, and then the problems will go away. But that's not my experience. You know, at 15 years old, I found alcohol. And just like our previous speakers, I mean, I put down all of that other stuff. I mean, I completely stopped playing sports. I stopped doing anything in terms of family relations and any of that stuff, and it just became the absolute center of my life. I mean, I can remember to this day the first time I put that stuff to my lips, and it went down in my body. I can feel the neck, and the hairs on my neck start to stand up, and I can feel the warmth in my body. It just felt electric, and for the first time, besides that little bit of relief that I found from sports, for the first time, it was like I felt okay being Greg, just doing what I was doing, where I was doing it, who I was doing it with. It was like the universe aligned in such a way that it was like it was magical. I found a new sense of freedom and happiness, and I wanted to feel like that as much as possible in a very short amount of time, from 15 years old to 19 years old. My life spiraled down pretty quickly, and I got into a lot of substances. And I got arrested for possession of crack cocaine, possession of a weapon, underage drinking, reckless driving, and DWI, all in a very short amount of time. And I don't share that with you because that qualifies me as an alcoholic. It just qualifies me as someone who's really sloppy and stupid and gets caught. You know, and I ended up going from treatment center to hospital to all those fun places that we visit. And in that brief time, I started to go to some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. And then eventually the court system, bless you, in Massachusetts and in Connecticut, because it was separate cases in two different states, made it very clear that I'm not playing a game of baseball and I don't get three strikes. So fear sobered me up this last time, August 15th, 2001. Fear sobered me up. I was a 19-year-old white kid from the suburbs of Orange, Connecticut. I don't wear khaki well. There's no way I'm going to jail. Like, I will die. I was like, it was pretty clear. I'm not trying to pretend to be someone who I'm not. Like, I will literally die if I go to prison. Like, there is no way this is happening. And the amount of time that they told me, I was like, whoa, no way. Like, there's got to be something. And I'm very fortunate and very lucky that I had a family that has resources to be able to provide to get me some lawyers that somehow convinced the legal system to allow me to go back one more time to treatment. Which I continuously would just keep leaving. So I went back this last time realizing, like, there was no other alternative. It was either this or die. And that's what I equated jail with, was I was going to die. Not that I was going to die from alcohol and drugs, but I'm going to die if I go to jail. And that's what I did. I proceeded to go to this treatment center. I stayed sober for about 3 months there, and then they sent me to a sober house, and I stayed sober in the sober house, and I started to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know where I heard it, but I just had this idea, like, if I can just somehow get my life right. And this is what getting my life right looks like to me. I'm like, all right, well, I got to get a membership at the gym and start working out again and go tanning at least twice a week. I got to get back to a job that makes a lot of money, so that means I got to work third shift so I can get time and a half. Work like 70, 80 hours a week, you know, this way I'll have enough money for what, I don't know, but I just need a lot of it, I guess, to tan a lot and go to the gym and get my car and pay all these fines for my DUIs and drunk driving and get my license reinstated. Not that there's anything wrong with that stuff, but this is just, you know, what I have a thinking. And I did that, and I proceeded to do that, and I was so terrified of going to jail. I mean, if there's anyone in this room who is staying sober on fear and fear itself, oh, man, that's so painful. It's so painful. And I proceeded to do that, and I met this really nice girl that went to a local university, and I started dating her. She wasn't an alcoholic, or at least she wasn't yet. And we had a pretty good relationship. My family was actually starting to talk to me. They were actually letting me come home for a couple hours at a time to visit. And things seemed to be going well. I was living in this house with other sober guys. I had these rules that I had to follow that was sort of stipulated me through the legal system and stuff. So it was pretty tight system and drug testing and all this stuff. And I proceeded to do that. And I would go to meetings on a regular basis, and I would see people at meetings, and I'm like, wow, man, look at you. You really got life by the balls. You're like 21, 22 years old, and, you know, I wish I got it at your age, and, you know, you got a pretty girlfriend, and look, you got a brand new Jeep, and you're a union carpenter, you're making tons of money, you're yellow like an orange, but you're starting to put some weight on. I mean, like, you know, I had to clean up really well on the outside, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm smiling, and I'm, you know, telling everyone how wonderful my life is, and it's getting good on the outside. I mean, really, on paper, my life is starting to really look good. And I was going to a lot of meetings of another fellowship, and I came up on a year. I came up on 365 days sober, and I went to this meeting on Friday night of Narcotics Anonymous, and I got a keychain. And they gave me this glow-in-the-dark keychain because they told me I didn't have to glow-in-the-dark anymore. And I still have no idea what the hell that meant, but it sounded really cool. And all these people invited me to hang out afterwards, you know, and do this fellowship stuff. And they said, come out, we're going to go to the diner, we're going to go bowling, and it's going to be fun. And I'm like, no, I'm like really busy, which in translation meant I'm going to go home to an empty sober house that's dark, completely by myself, and I'm going to sulk in my own self-pity. So I have a full night. But thank you. And I did. I went home to my dark, empty, really quiet, sober house in my own thoughts. And I'm looking at my life, you know, this reflecting this year anniversary, these 365 days of sobriety that I just put together. And I'm thinking about all these people that I met at the meetings. And I'm thinking about all that I can hear in my head was these people saying, look at you, man. Like, you got everything. Your life is perfect. You're 22 years old. You got a great job. You're making tons of money. You're a union carpenter. You got a pretty girlfriend. Your family's talking to you. You got your car back. You got your license back. You're going to get through this with a clean slate, no record. Like, who's got a better life than you? And the reality was, it's like, damn, that does sound pretty good. But why the hell am I so miserable? And, you know, my head started to experience some pretty dark thoughts. And I don't know if anyone's ever experienced this, but I just started to feel like I was in quicksand. And I was, like, trying to pull myself out of it. And I was trying to be positive, and I was trying to sort of turn some things around, but it just, I was sinking. And I got to the point where, and I tell you folks, up to this point, it was like drugs and alcohol weren't even attractive. Booze and other substances weren't even attractive at this point. It was like I was almost able to sort of cut through that delusion, and I knew exactly what was going to happen. It didn't even seem like it was a place of relief for me, you know? But yet I'm looking at my life at this point in a year of sobriety, doing this sober thing, right? Going to 2 to 3 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to this point where it sort of stepped down, but I was still going to at least a meeting a day. I had a sponsor. I'm hanging out with a house full of sober people. I'm doing sober things. I'm so terrified of going to jail. I'm not even, someone told me if I eat poppy seed bagels, I was going to like test positive for opiates. So I'm not even eating poppy seed bagels. I'm not taking Motrins because I'm afraid something's going to come up false positive. I mean, I'm like, straight, I mean, I'm not touching anything. And I'm like, I can't do this. Like, 22, like, this is it. Like, God, if I live another 5 years, I can't take this. You know? And so at 22 years old, 1 year of sobriety on my anniversary, just getting back from meeting Narcotics Anonymous, was the first time in my life I thought about committing suicide. Sober. You know, my bottom was that night. It wasn't alcohol. It wasn't other substances. It was sobriety. Sobriety beat me down. I mean, to the point that I just didn't want to go on. Folks, alcohol and drugs were never my problem. They were always my solution. Alcohol did not tear my life apart. Alcohol was the glue that held it together. Alcohol was the thing that kept me from experiencing that night. That's what alcohol did for me. Don't get me wrong, alcohol caused a lot of problems. It just wasn't the problem. And so I'll back up very quickly. Through that year, I did have to get what is called a sponsor. It was one of those requirements to live in this sober house, which then I had to follow all those requirements so I didn't go to jail and die. So I got this guy to be my sponsor. And I was supposed to meet with him this one night. It was a snowstorm. You know, my phone rang, and he said, "Hey, Greg, this is Chris. You okay?" I'm like, "Yeah." I'm like, "Who the heck is this?" I'm thinking in my head. I'm like, he's like, "Dude, we were supposed to meet at Starbucks and we're going to go over some step work." And I'm like, "Who are you?" He's like, "Oh, my name's Chris. Remember, I'm your sponsor?" And I'm like, "Oh, dude, I had to go meet my girlfriend because I totally forgot that I double booked." And I'm like, "Well, I'm going to go meet Lindsay, but dude, I'll catch you some other time." And I never talked to him again. And that night, for whatever reason, he was the only guy that I can think of, the only person I can think of to call. And I called him. And I think back and I'm like, that guy had every right not to, one, pick up the phone, or two, to even take the time to listen to what I had to say. You know, but he did, and he listened to what I had to say, and after I got done explaining to him everything and telling him that I feel like I'm not even sober, dude, I don't even know what's going on, I feel like I'm losing my mind, I feel like I'm about to end my life. And he says, "It sounds like you're suffering from untreated alcoholism." He says, "I don't really know what your problem is, Greg, and I don't really know what you need to do, but I will share with you what my problem is, and I will share with you what I do today. And if any of this makes sense or you can relate to or gives you any little bit of hope, then I will be more than willing to and happy to show you what I'm talking about." And I hung up that phone and I went over to his apartment in New Haven, Connecticut. And within a very short amount of time, in a couple hours, we were on our knees saying a third step prayer. And he gave me a piece of paper. And in that short period of time, he started to explain some things to me that I probably heard a million times, but for whatever reason, I really heard it that night. I mean, it hit me like a direct hit right between the eyes. And he was explaining this phenomenon of craving that I always heard and I always understand. And then he explained this obsession of the mind, and I kind of got that too. I'm back. You know, I kind of got that obsession thing too, but it was a spiritual malady that I never really heard for whatever reason. And that was the thing that I was always suffering from. That was the thing that always sort of confused me. You know, I knew that I was different than my fellows physically. That made sense. Once I start, I can't stop. I mean, that was, no one needed to really explain that to me. And the whole obsession of the mind, it took a little while, but eventually after enough experiences and look at my, you know, my truth, I saw that. But this malady of the spirit and the way that he just explained it, it just made sense and it hit me. And at that moment, you know, as he was saying, he's like, Greg, you haven't had a drink or a drug in a year. How can this be the problem? And it made so much sense that drinking and drugs never was the problem. It was living. I'm not a problem drinker. You know, if I put down the drink or the drug, my problems don't go away. They just begin. I'm an answer drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from alcoholism, the malady in my spirit. You know, this disconnect, this delusion that I'm disconnected from you, from myself, and from God. And I felt connected in this false sense of way when I put those substances in my body, and a lot of other sort of false things sort of produced that throughout my life. And he says, very simply, Greg, if your problem is powerlessness and your life became unmanageable as a result of this powerlessness, let's look at it like this. If you had no shoes, right? If you were shoeless, you can relate to that. You like shoes, I do. And he says, your life became unmanageable because you have no shoes, and what are you going to need? I'm like, I guess a pair of shoes. He's like, very good. If you were jobless and your life became unmanageable, what would you need? I'm like, well, this is tough. A job? He's like, all right, so if you're powerless and your life became unmanageable as a result of not having that power, what do you need? I'm like, a power. He says, that's it. That's simple. So I said, well, what does this power look like? How do I get this power? He says, well, very simply. He says, are you just willing to believe that there is a power bigger than you or bigger than alcohol and drugs? And I said, yeah. He says, okay, well, that's all you need. And then we got down on our knees and we said a 30-step prayer. And I have no idea what the heck I said in terms of words. I remember us opening the book, and now I can look back and I'm like, oh, that was definitely saying the 30-step prayer. But at the time, I had no idea what the heck I was doing. But I was willing, and I took the action. And he gave me this list, and I just went ahead and I started writing people down. Resentments, fears, and sexual misconduct. And then eventually, once I was finished, I went back to his apartment. And I started sharing this stuff with him. And there were some of these things that I didn't put on paper because I was like, there's no way I'm telling a person. No way I'm telling a man this stuff. You know, things that I would have to do when I was on the streets, things that I'm not going to get into detail from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, but things I would wake up in the morning and I'd scrub myself so hard to remove the guilt and the shame and the disgust that I'd start bleeding on my arms from rubbing so hard. And my jaw started shaking, and I'm rumbling in this chair, and I knew at that moment if I wasn't completely honest, I would not be free. And I started sharing some stuff with him, and he just started sharing some stuff back to me, just like that. And for the first time, I didn't feel less than this man or better than this man. I just felt right there with him. And he told me to give some time and to sort of sit by myself for an hour and think about what I've been doing. And if I was ready to move forward, and he pointed some things out. He pointed out fear and selfishness and self-centeredness, you know? And he says, if you're ready to have these removed, then say this simple prayer. And folks, I remember getting on my knees and once again, not really remembering so much the words of it, but I remember my heart feeling like, God, if you're real and this is what I need to be doing and this is truly going to help me, I will do whatever I need to do. And I remember getting up from my knees that night, and my life has not been the same since. Something happened. Something changed. Something shifted inside of me. I don't know what, where, when, why, or how, and I don't care. I just know that it did. And I continue on with the rest of these 12 steps, and I've had some amazing experiences, some phenomenal experiences with the men's. And I'll share really quickly. I have no idea where I am with time, but 9 minutes?
Yeah, 7 and a half.
I'll make it quick. I'll try to be honest. So in most of my men's, the kind of like pretty cool story in men's is I didn't even have these people on paper. I didn't even have them on my 8-step because that's how crazy I was. I'm at the mall with my sister and we're walking and you know, through the mall, and I passed by this store called Abercrombie and Fitch, and the like smell hits me and I'm like, oh, you ever have those experiences where just like you smell something and this like memory comes back or this vision? And that smell of Abercrombie hit me, and it like all of a sudden in my head, all I could think about was like stuffing clothes and bags and under my arms and like walking out of the store with it. I'm like, shit, I used to steal from this place. And I turned to my sister and I'm like, Amanda, I gotta, you know, part of A&A is I gotta go and do these like amends, and I used to steal from this store. And she's like, Greg, come on, like how many stores? You used to steal from all the stores in this mall. I'm like, oh yeah. But I'm like, I particularly remember this one. And she said, well, you've been sober now for a little while, and what are you going to do? Are you going to, like, go tell him? I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm going to do. She's like, you do know if you get arrested, Mom was going to, she's going to kill you. So she's like, I'm going to go wait in the car. Swear to God. She's like, I'm going to go wait in the car, and if I don't see you in a little bit, I'm going to call her. And I said, okay. So I walk in the store and I ask for the manager, and this like kid the same age as me comes out, and I said, hey, dude, I'm a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did some things in my past that I'm not proud of, and part of that is I stole from your store, and I'm here to set that right. You know, I was very selfish and dishonest, and anything that I can do to make this right, I'm willing to do at this point. And he says, hold on 1 second, and he left. And you ever have one of those experiences where, like, your mind's racing a million miles an hour, but you can't move your body? Like, I was frozen. And my mind is screaming, like, run, run, run. And I'm like, literally, I can't. And I'm like, and he comes out, and he has his business card. And he says, this is Loss Prevention out of California. Give them a call. And I'm like, is that it? And he's like, yeah, I've never experienced this before. I don't know what else to do. So I was like, all right, no, I'll definitely do that. And as I'm like turning around and get ready to leave, he's like, wait, hold on, man. I was like, what? He's like, are you employed? And I'm like, yeah, I got a job. He's like, oh, okay. I was like, why? He's like, well, you know, I'm just kind of blown away by this. He's like, we all make mistakes in life, but it takes a certain type of person to come back and sort of right that wrong, and I'd love to have you come work for me. And I'm like, you do realize I stole from you? He's like, yeah, I know that. There's a lot of people that steal from us. He says, so I was like, well, let me check with my sponsor and, you know, I'll see. And I never ended up taking the job, but, you know, I called Loss Prevention and this woman, I didn't get into detail with her, and I'm just telling her some things. And by the end of the conversation, after she yelled at me for a little bit and told me to write a really large check and write a letter of apology, she asked me, she said, Mr. Plakis, are you a part of that A&A thing? And I said, yeah. She said, well, that's awesome. You guys call all the time. swear to God. And it is a funny story, but to take me back to that time, that experience, it was one of those experiences that just made me feel my feet are planted in the right place. This is real. This isn't mystical or fairy dust or like, you know, some pie in the sky. Like, this is real. Like, this stuff is real. And many experiences along the way. One of my, you know, favorite speakers is this guy, Chuck C., my great-grand sponsor, but he's not alive anymore. And you know, he would say these, like, one-liners that would just drive me crazy, and they still do. And one of them was, like, I'm so grateful I can't see. And he's, like, one of those people in, like, A, when they say something, and I'm the type of guy, I'm like, well, can you explain that? Like, just don't throw it out there and, like, leave it up to me to figure it out, because I can't. And it drives me crazy. I think about it for weeks and months and years. And it was this one thing, and it always got me. I'm like, what is that crazy old man talking about? Like, I'm so grateful I can't see. Like, explain that. And this one day I woke up, and I meditated, and I prayed, and I showered, and I ate some breakfast, and I got in the car, and I was going to go meet this woman that I was sponsoring to go do some step work with her. And I'm sitting there driving, and the sun's beaming on my face, and I start thinking about my life and the shame and the guilt and the loneliness and the remorse, and just getting to the point, drinking and drugging, and even in that time of sobriety where I wanted to kill myself. And then I'm thinking about my life at this moment, how I just woke up and I was praying, and I was meditating, and I showered, and I was eating breakfast, and I'm going to help some woman and get nothing in return. And I just started crying, these tears of joy, and I literally could not see. And I turned my car over to the side of the road, and I thought of that crazy old man Chuck C., and I'm like, oh my God. This is what he meant. You know, we get filled with joy. You know, happiness is a byproduct of getting something. Joy just is. And I'm telling you, when you're living this life based upon spiritual principles and you're trusting in God, you know, and you're just consistently trying to lend your hand out to other brothers and sisters, you will be filled with joy on a consistent basis. My life is like a rocket ship. I've been blasted into the fourth dimension. I mean, undescribable. I mean, I've been through some ups and downs in the past 14 years. I've lost jobs. I've gotten divorced. I've lost some really close people to me. And I've had some really highs in life as well, too. But through those highs and through those lows, there's been a consistent. And my saving grace is really just sitting down one-on-one helping other men and women. I mean, that's what's gotten me through. That's been the saving grace. When times are really troubled and I just feel like not so much my sobriety is in question, but my sanity is in question. Working with another alcoholic always saves the day. You know, my life is not Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. You know, I'm lucky if I get the one meeting a week. You know, but I spend the majority of my time trying to help others. You know, and that's where I find my peace. That's where I find my serenity. That's where I find my sanctuary. That's where I find my God. You know, the greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, besides a relationship with God, is me. Me. That's the greatest gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Is me, and that's all I've wanted. It's just to be okay being me with all my quirkiness and, you know, bad jokes and, you know, stupidity and just everything that I am. Like, I really would rather be no other place than right here, right now, in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with you. Where am I? Boston? Brighton? I don't know where I am. In Brighton on a Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. I mean, that's priceless. That's priceless. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Now we have Mahendran and Christina for festivities.
Hi, my name is Mahendran. I'm an alcoholic. So there's a turkey bowl going on tonight at Boston Bowl. From 9, yeah, bowling, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. Yeah, bowl. And Nekipa is hosting a speaker jam and ugly sweater competition and game night. And that's going to be Saturday, December 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. at 404 Concord Ave in Belmont, Mass.
Hi, I'm Christina. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Christina.
So on Monday night, the Beacon Group hosts a big book meeting, Beacon by the Book, at 8 p.m. at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. The address is 1581 Beacon Street, and all are welcome to attend. And after tonight's meeting, we have fellowship at Eagles Deli over in Cleveland Circle. It's about a five-minute walk from here. It's at 1918 Beacon Street, and all are welcome to head over there after the meeting as well. This evening, so there's a Thanksgiving Alcathon in Watertown. It started at 7 p.m. tonight, and it runs through 7 p.m. tomorrow night. So if anyone's looking for a meeting, it runs all throughout. It's at the Grace Vision Church at 80 Mount Auburn Street. And for those who don't know what an Alcathon is, it's just we host back-to-back meetings, run through the whole night, lots of fellowship, sometimes food, raffles, things like that. I don't know about this one in particular, but... And then... I'm also announcing the Christmas Alcathon is going to be on Thursday, December 24th, beginning at 6 p.m. until midnight, and then it will pick up again on Friday, December 25th, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's at the Massachusetts College of Art, which is on Huntington Ave off of the E Line train on the Green Line, and Ali is actually looking for volunteers to speak. There you go. Oh, just to volunteer. Got it. To volunteer to fill out slots to help out with the event. So if you're interested in that, please see Ali after the meeting. And I'll put this flyer that advertises it over on the board. And then also wanted to announce, the last announcement is that there's going to be an anniversary walk for Chloe on December 31st, so New Year's Eve. It's a Thursday night. What a better way to ring in the new year. That'll be at 9:30 p.m. or beginning at 9:30 p.m. at IHOP at 1850 Soldiers Field Road. And that's it. Thanks.
For chips, we have Gretchen and Phil.
Hi everyone, my name is John, I'm an alcoholic. Here at the Beacon Group, we have a custom of handing out chips for various lengths of sobriety. So if you hear a chip, please come up here tonight. They're right here. Oh, I was like holding on. Yeah, it helps. First chip is for 18 months. 12 months? Just kidding. 11 months? 10 months? 9 months? 8 months? 7 months? 6 months? There you go. Six months? 6 months again? 5 months? There you go. Four? How about three? There you go. Two months. There you go. 1 month. Finally, the most important chip of all, 24 hours, 29 days, or desire to stop drinking. To show the program works, with all those with a year or more, please raise your hand. And if you made it to a meeting today, give yourself a hand. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Gretchen. I'm an alcoholic. Bear with me here. All right. Years and multiple years are celebrated on the last Wednesday of the month. This is an opportunity for Beacon members to come and express their gratitude for a minute or so. We suggest that all Beacon Group celebrants make a donation of $1 per year of sobriety to be sent to GSO. And of course, excellent cake will be served. In an effort to promote unity and enhance sobriety, we here at Beacon Group sponsor an anniversary watch. This is an opportunity for Beacon Group members on their 365th day to sit down with their sponsor and friends beginning at 9:30 p.m. to watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at IHOP at 1850 Soldiers Field Road in Brighton. And I think that's it. If you would like to celebrate your anniversary with us this month or would like to have an anniversary watch, please see our anniversary person, Kelly, after the meeting. Thank you. Thank you.